Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Welcome to our continuing discussions, virtual discussions at the Sydney Institute at a time of pandemic. And we have Margaret Somerville, who's making a welcome return. The topic for today's discussion, our speaker will speak some time, and then we'll have questions discussion after, and thanks to our associate members who've sent in questions to be discussed. And the topic is the lethal collision of two pandemics, COVID-19 and ageism. Now, Margaret Somerville is a professor of ethics in the medical school at the University of Notre Dame. She's a qualified pharmacist. She's admitted to the bar in Quebec and in New South Wales. And from McGill University, she has a doctorate in medicine, ethics, and law, which qualifies her to be an ethicist. And so Margaret, Dr. Somerville makes a welcome return on the topic of the lethal collision of these two pandemics. Margaret Somerville, thank you.
Thank you, Jared, and it's a great pleasure to be back at the Sydney Institute, and nice to see you back in your ancestral home here on Phillip Street, instead of one of those high rises. So what this talk centres around is that I think that elderly people can be described as the ethical canary in the COVID-19 pandemic coal mine, and that they're the canaries that are warning us about the ethical tone of our contemporary Australian society. The ethical tone of a society is not determined by how it treats its most powerful, strongest, most affluent members, but by how it treats its weakest, most in need, and most vulnerable members. Those people are the litmus test of this society's ethical tone. And that group includes some elderly persons in some aged care institutions. And the question that I asked in thinking about these remarks was, what does our appalling treatment of some of them, in particular in the COVID-19 pandemic, tell us about ourselves and the ethical tone of our contemporary Australian society? So the first thing I'd like to look at is what we can call basic presumptions. Basic presumptions are important in ethical decision making because they reflect our values and biases. They influence our decisions about what is and is not ethical. And when we're in a situation of equal doubt about what we should do, the basic presumption governs. For example, let us imagine we're torn in deciding whether an old person in an aged care institution who's seriously ill with COVID-19 should be admitted to hospital. If our basic presumption is yes, hospital treatment should be provided to all who need it, but then the exception is, but not if, the person will be admitted to hospital unless those arguing against this can establish that the exception, that is the conditions for not admitting them to hospital, are fulfilled. And note that those conditions must be ethically acceptable, so they must not include age discrimination or any other wrongful discrimination. In contrast, if our basic presumption is the alternative one, No, hospital treatment should not be provided unless, and we have to work out what the unlesses are, then in exactly the same circumstances, when we are in equal doubt about whether to put the person in hospital or not, in exactly the same circumstances, the person will not receive treatment unless the person arguing for treatment can prove that the conditions for providing it, that is the exception to the no judgment, are fulfilled. Now, Saturday morning, I was watching ABC TV channel 24, and an ABC journalist reported doctors are saying Melbourne hospitals were full because people with COVID-19 were now being transferred. They hadn't been in the past in such numbers, but they were being transferred from aged care homes, and that meant that other people presenting in emergency were experiencing serious and unacceptable delays. He quoted one case where the other person, other than an aged care person with COVID, that person waited 60 hours. And he went on to say that beds are needed for these other people and they're not available because of the transfer of elderly people from aged care homes. The journalists seemed to be very clearly employing a basic presumption that the latter category of patients, that is, not those who were not aged people with COVID, should have priority for hospitalisation over the elderly people with COVID. The same presumption probably underlies the directive that aged care residents with COVID-19 must not be transferred to hospital, issued by the New South Wales Chief Health Officer, Dr. Kerry Chant, to Anglicare's Newmarch House, where at least 17 residents died of COVID-19, and I believe I heard this morning on the news that that number is now 19. So the number of people dying of COVID in aged care homes without hospitalisation is very high. Belgium presents a striking case of such an approach. At the beginning of the pandemic in Belgium, approximately two-thirds of people who died from COVID-19, the vast majority of whom were elderly, died in hospital. So in other words, at the beginning, the elderly people were being transferred to hospital. Now, only around 14% of the aged people in Belgium who die of COVID die in hospital, so they've stopped doing that. I've tried to ascertain how many Belgian COVID-19 deaths are by euthanasia. Approximately 5% of all deaths in Belgium are by euthanasia, but I was unable to obtain these figures. The absence of that information is also true for Victoria in relation to its voluntary assisted dying provisions. Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, have released a recent report that included surveying the mental health of people in aged care homes in Belgium and found that the people's consideration of resorting to euthanasia had increased since the COVID-19 epidemic. Reports of elderly residents of aged care facilities with COVID-19 being sedated with morphine and other drugs have also emerged, and the ethical concern here is twofold. First, sedation as a form of what's called euphemistically chemical restraint, or more forthrightly as behaviour control, is uniformly condemned as unethical. Many aged care facilities are understaffed, whether chronically or because of COVID-19, and moreover, they lack sufficient or even any healthcare professionals permanently available on staff. This lack can also be a link to an unethical failure to transfer seriously ill residents to hospital, because a doctor or nurse must authorise the transfer before ambulance attendants will comply. There have been stories of ambulances arriving at aged care homes, and when the authorization from a doctor or a nurse was not present, refusing to take the people to hospital. Sometimes, and we've got to be clear about this, systems are intentionally established in such a way as to hinder attribution of responsibility for breaches of ethics. And to avoid unethical or negligent systems, we must expressly embed ethics in the system from its initiation. As well, the second use of sedation, that at the end of life, is very ethically sensitive. When sedation is the only reasonable way to relieve serious suffering, appropriate drugs and doses are used, and there is no primary intention to shorten the person's life, it is ethically acceptable palliative care. It's sometimes called palliative sedation. When sedation does not fulfill those conditions, for example, the nature of the drug or the dose is much more than is needed for sedation, and it's used as a form of so-called terminal sedation, which is a euphemism for euthanasia, it is slow euthanasia and ethically unacceptable if you don't agree with euthanasia, which I don't. The latter use is increasingly common in Belgium and the Netherlands, that is the use of sedation at the end of life to cause death to occur, that the person is not given hydration or nutrition, they're not woken up, they're not treated with any treatments, and they eventually die. And what people have been asking recently, why has the number of those terminal sedations increased so markedly in recent times? And one possible explanation for this dramatically expanded use is that it's less psychologically traumatic for doctors than administering euthanasia by lethal injections. For example, the Dutch Medical Association has been worried about the mental health of some doctors who carry out euthanasia, that it is affecting their mental well-being. So these are very complicated situations. The next topic I want to look at, and these are all kind of subtopics under this idea of old people in nursing homes who contract COVID-19, and how can we explain how they're being looked after, or perhaps more accurately, not looked after properly or adequately. So the next topic is what we call in ethics a world of competing sorrows. And the situations that I just described to you about people being conflicted whether to put people in hospital or not, and that there's no harm option, that if you put all the old people in hospital, there won't be beds for people who need them for heart attacks or brain hemorrhages or strokes or whatever else. And so that's what a world of competing sorrows is. It's when there is no harm option and you have to choose who will suffer the harm. There's also been some research coming out of Italy, which had a horrific pandemic early on, about the trauma to doctors who had two patients, for example, needing a respirator, and they only had one respirator, and they had to decide which patient got the respirator. This research showed that some of those doctors were long contemplating, had they made the right decision, that they had guilt, they had moral anxiety and moral trauma. So these are very difficult decisions when you have no harm option. There are, however, some principles that can guide us in these situations. One of the important ones is that we have obligations to have what's called a preferential option in favour of the weakest, most in need, most vulnerable people. Now you see, that fits with our idea of how we test the ethical tone of our society. And those people should all, when we can't do the best for everyone, those people should have a priority. Another principle is that those who suffer the burdens should have access to the benefits that result. Now that means, for instance, that healthcare professionals should have priority access to any treatments or preventive measures which are discovered, and likewise volunteers for COVID-19 research. They have voluntarily taken on the burdens to help others. So when we have some benefits, they should be first in line to get those benefits. There was a discussion just this morning on the television that the Prime Minister has announced that when a vaccine is available, it will be free to all Australians. And immediately questions started arising about, well, what about other people outside Australia? And that's a major discussion point internationally at the moment of what do we owe not just to our own society or community or nation, but what do we owe to everybody else? Very difficult to answer. That helping people also means that as a community or society, we have obligations to reduce to the lowest possible level the risks that healthcare people take to care for people with COVID-19. It's appalling that in some hospitals or aged care institutions, staff have been telling us that they have inadequate personal protective equipment and that practices such as reusing contaminated equipment and so on are happening. As Shakespeare said, the primrose path to the everlasting bonfire is paved with good intentions. So what about these lockdowns that we have? We're trying to protect people from COVID-19 with lockdowns, but they're losing their jobs and their capacity to support their families, as well as suffering the mental trauma that involves. And again, there was talk today on the press club interview with Natasha Scott-Desquoyer about the increase in family violence because everybody's locked up together at home because of the COVID-19 lockdown. So we have to take those other harms into account. We also have to understand that although this saying that we're all in the COVID crisis together is true, some of us are much more vulnerable than others of us in that crisis. We must also consider the breaches of human rights that preventive measures can involve, such as loss of liberty and freedom of assembly. People are mourning the fact they can't go to the football match. Other people that they can't go to church on Sunday. Others that they can't have a wedding. And perhaps most seriously of all, those who've lost their loved one and can't have the funeral that they think is appropriate. One thing you can say about COVID-19 is that its tentacles are incredibly long and diverse and powerful. And if you sit down to try to write down all the things that it's causing, you can sort of start in the middle with the health concerns, but then you move out, and it's amazing how many things it's disrupting. It's a great societal, global disruption. And I don't think that we've got a clear idea at all of how we'll come out on the other side of that. The next topic I want to address is what I call ethics of different levels of decision making and action. There are four levels of ethical decision making and action resulting from the decisions taken. They can only be briefly identified here, but all are relevant to dealing ethically with COVID-19. The first level is micro or individual level, and the most important and basic question at that level is, what do I owe to others to keep them safe, and what do others owe to me to keep me safe? And one of the relationships we can look at here is the doctor-patient relationship. The doctor has a primary obligation of personal care to each individual patient. That means the doctor must act in that person's best interest, which must come first, and he or she can't put any other person's interests in front of that person. And that can go to being requiring the doctor to be a patient advocate for the elderly patient. So you can imagine back to the refusal to admit elderly patients seriously ill with COVID-19 into a hospital. The doctor ethically has an obligation to try to fight for the treatment that that patient needs. That's one of the safeguards in our system, that because an individual doctor has an individual obligation to each and every patient, their patient has got this person on their side, even when a whole lot of other people and the system is stacked against the patient getting what they need. Now, it doesn't always work, but at least we can make a try. The second level is what I call the meso or institutional level. And the ethical principles and consideration which should govern in aged care institutions involve organizational, institutional, and systems ethics. And they also require ethics preparedness, including for a pandemic. That is an ethical requirement. Now, there is a very good document in Australia that was developed during the SARS crisis in 2007, 2008, or 2009, and that has got a list of ethical considerations to be taken into account in it. I'm not sure that, and one of them is ethics preparedness, but I'm not sure whether we really have that, or sometimes even if you think you're prepared, the actual realization of the risk that you've been worried about is so overwhelming that you can't cope with it easily, and I think that's probably true of COVID-19. So the other thing that we have to be careful of here with institutions such as hospitals and other care homes or even medical associations is that just following institutional policies or guidelines does not automatically mean that we're acting ethically. Indeed, some policies or guidelines can be unethical. For example, those that breach human rights because they discriminate on the basis of age or disability. Now, this has happened in some European countries in this pandemic. They gave an order, depending on the country, that nobody over 65, in other cases 70, in other cases 75 or 80, was to be hospitalized or put on a ventilator. Now, that is contrary to human rights and a policy that is just automatically, routinely applied. That in itself is an unethical approach to making the decision about treatment for the person who is subject to that decision. However, unlike at the individual level, effectiveness of the treatment and efficiency of the use of what you're doing, and especially efficiency in the use of healthcare resources and justice, are ethically valid primary considerations at this level. because a hospital doesn't only have an ethical obligation to each individual patient, they also have an ethical obligation to all the patients that they will have present at their hospital. And they have to think about careful use, that is effectiveness and efficiency, and justice. How do you share these resources fairly and justly? But what this does mean is that you cannot, however, as an institution, have a blanket rule, for example, refusal of treatment for certain people no matter what, without even looking at the individual circumstances of that person. In my view, that is unethical. We must also, at the least, consider each person's claims and needs on their merits. And in this context, as explained already, the choice of a basic presumption is very important. If you have a basic presumption, all people should be treated equally, for example, no matter what their age. So yes, they should be given the treatment that's indicated and that they need. Then that is much more likely you end in treatment for the person than a presumption that says no, if you are, let's say, elderly, or if you are a resident of an aged care home, we won't give you that treatment, even though we would give it to someone else with the same health profile if they were not old and not in an aged care home. Legally, there are some very big issues arise too in relation to this. Civil or criminal liability can arise from a failure to provide medical care. There are legal duties to provide what are called in the law the necessaries of life, which include basic hygiene and medical care and food to a person in one's care, custody or control who is unable to provide those necessaries of life for themselves. And again, we've heard horror stories of old people not receiving food and of being left with soiled nightwear and soiled beds. That is actually legally wrong, let alone ethically wrong. Wanton and reckless indifference to human life or safety can be civil or criminal negligence, and medical negligence, medical malpractice, is also a relevant consideration. So, as you can see, there's a huge number of issues and considerations and principles brought into play. Then, so that was level two, the institution or meso level. Level three is the macro or societal level. And the ethical issues include what I've called hyper-bureaucratization of public health officials' decisions. I was on the National Advisory Committee on HIV/AIDS to the Canadian government, and I had regular run-ins with one of the heads of public health in Canada, who used to call me Miss Lawyer. He really seriously disliked me. And before he'd say what they were going to do, he would say, well, Miss Lawyer won't like this. And usually I didn't like it. But also, he had a saying that he used a lot, which was, we mustn't panic the public. And sometimes public health officials, I mean, I think they've done a fabulous job here. And I think they are being transparent. And I think we've been incredibly well informed. In fact, sometimes I think we've just swamped in COVID information. But you know, you do have to watch that people are not acting in that way of not panicking the public, and therefore the public don't really know what's going on. There can also be this is to take a phrase from Jared Henderson. I saw this in The Australian and thought it was excellent. He spoke of ideologically driven intolerance, which I think is a perfect phrase. And I would add to that, Jared, politically or ideologically generated intolerance can be a cause of problems in ethical decision-making at the societal level. Failure to remedy socioeconomic disparities in health status or to provide support for the most vulnerable people and so on. are also ethical responsibilities at the societal level, whether it is the politicians or it's bureaucracy or whoever the responsible people should be. And you should keep in mind, it doesn't have to be just one department or one person. These are very able to be shared responsibilities. Public health's mandate of avoiding danger to citizens and ensuring their safety is an exercise of what's called the state's police power, which is a coercive power and much broader than its parent's patriae power, which is its other power, which is the power of a parent, of a good parent, to look after those whom they should look after, to protect those unable to protect themselves. Although both powers and their concomitant obligations are relevant to fulfilling the justified claims of elderly persons. Then we come to the fourth level, the mega or global level. Ethical issues include principles governing research on a vaccine, especially when that research is carried out in developing countries, which may not have the same safeguards that we do on the ethics of research, and access to a vaccine when it becomes available, which I've already mentioned. There's concern of people who are pro-life about the use of tissue from intentionally aborted fetuses to manufacture a vaccine. Then we've got fraudulent research has proven to be a problem. Probably the two most eminent medical journals in the world, The Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine, published a paper arguably showing on a huge database sample that hydroxychloroquine, the drug that Donald Trump is espousing, was not of any benefit, and indeed it may cause harm to the people taking it. And these papers saying it was not of benefit were published in those two journals. It later turned out that the research was fraudulent, that the data that the researchers based their conclusions on did not exist, and indeed one of the African countries had withdrawn the use of hydroxychloroquine. They were running trials of it, as indeed were people in the United States and other countries. And in fact, here in Sydney, I got consulted by one doctor researcher who was doing this here. And so everybody stopped these trials. And then it was found out that this data was false. And so the two journals withdrew the papers, and then the trials commenced again. But it was a tremendous disruption in what could have been useful medical research on the basis of fraudulent claims. And then we've got things at the mega or macro level, global level, about the shortage of protective equipment for healthcare workers, which is a big problem in developing countries. It's heartbreaking to see these people struggling to make makeshift protection for themselves. And in that category too, I would put media ethics and media reporting on COVID-19. So there's overlap among the levels. Take, for example, issues relating to elderly persons. They arise at more than one level and include elderly persons' rights to protection and access to care, respect for dignity of the person, balancing aged care institutions' obligations to each resident and to all residents, government responsibility for funding aged care and for persons with disabilities, and so on. Ethics responsibility is not like a football in that one person can divest themselves of it by throwing it to another person. This approach was manifest among people involved in the decision to let COVID-19 infected passengers off the Ruby Princess cruise ship disembark in Sydney, quickly trying to pass the blame on to someone else. Rather, ethics responsibility is like a cake. Everybody can have a slice. The next topic, and we're getting near to the conclusion now, is social capital. Philosopher Robert Putman describes social capital as the features of social organizations, such as networks, norms, and social trust, that facilitate coordination and cooperation for mutual benefit. A major question is, will how we deal with COVID-19 as individuals, families, communities, state societies, and an Australian society increase or decrease our social capital? Our actions and responses are highly unlikely to be neutral in that regard. They will do either one or the other. So what do we need to do if we want to pass on to future generations societies in which reasonable people would want to live? So in conclusion, overall, in my opinion, Australia's done very well in managing the COVID-19 pandemic, but not in aged care, where the Aged Care Royal Commission has been told 68% of Australia's COVID-19 deaths have occurred. It's the second highest rate of death in residential aged care from COVID in the world. We need to ask ourselves why this is. A partial explanation is that older people face a greater risk of death from the virus. Another important reason, however, is rampant ageism in Australia, wrongful discrimination against elderly persons. The collision of two pandemics, COVID-19 and ageism, is indeed lethal. We do not respect elderly people or their human dignity. Our Aboriginal brothers and sisters are an exception, and we other Australians have much to learn from them in this regard. Sometimes this failure of respect is subtle. For example, a panelist on ABC's TV's The Insiders last Sunday pointed out that the media is speaking of aged care residents being decanted to hospitals. We decant wine and other things, not persons. Such language depersonalizes, dehumanizes, and allows us to disidentify from elderly people. It reassures us that we are not like them and never will be. Words matter, and nowhere more so than in ethics decision making. People are supporting legalized euthanasia because they would rather be dead than admitted to an aged care residence. In the context of COVID-19, heartbreaking footage of desperate elderly people trying to communicate with their loved ones through locked windows should spur us to instant remedial action. We all justly fear dying alone. Thank you.
Many thanks to Margaret Sandoval for a challenging paper, and so we come to question and discussion time, and thanks to our social members who sent in some suggestions. Thank you.
Thanks for a lively presentation, Margaret Sandoval. So can I put to you a different view that those who are doing best as a general rule in Australian society at a time of pandemic are retired people, people whether they have their own superannuation policy or whether they're on a pension, because essentially that income is guaranteed, not so much for the privately insured but for pensioners, but they're pretty well guaranteed. And people in the public sector of all ages who are keeping their jobs pretty well, from young ones to those sort of heading up to retirement age, which these days is probably around the 60s, there's no rigid term. And they're the ones who are doing it easiest. And of that group, a very small group of that group are in aged care homes. But you see the pandemic as striking essentially at the old, whereas I see it as striking essentially at the young. So what about the young? What about the intergenerational issue here? Because young people are losing their jobs more than older people are losing their jobs. Their security is more threatened than older people. So how do you see the younger types?
Well, Joe, just because you care about one group of people, and I concentrated on the old people in nursing homes, because I think they're such a powerful example, you know, that they can't activate our conscience and activate our ethics, then I don't know who can. But you're absolutely right, young people are having a terrible time too. Not all of them, but some of them. So yes, you're right. I mean, just because I focused on the aged people here, doesn't mean that we don't need to focus on other people and do what we can for them. But I think that the thing is, has our society become fragmented in such a way that these people, whether they're the very old or the very young, who are both the most vulnerable groups, that they don't feel that they belong, they don't feel they've got a future, they don't feel that life is worth living. I mean, it's what Viktor Frankl said, that if you've got a why to live, you can always find a how. And so one assumes that for the young people, they've got no why to live. And what have we not done that we haven't allowed them to find that? And maybe I think that's true with some old people too, that they, I mean, one of the things that came out in some of the surveys that an awful lot of them said how deeply lonely they were. Loneliness, and certainly in the places that allowed euthanasia, loneliness was a major reason for them wanting euthanasia. So, you know, these are the things we're dealing with. And it's pretty frightening to think, it's tragic outcomes, and can we stop it? Can we make it better?
As an ethicist, do you distinguish between death by suicide and death by euthanasia?
Do I distinguish between...
Between death by suicide and death by euthanasia?
I distinguish between death by assisted suicide. And I don't distinguish between that and euthanasia. A suicide is not euthanasia. Just if it's not an assisted suicide or the person is helped to kill themselves in some way.
Why is suicide not euthanasia? I mean, if you kill yourself...
Because euthanasia involves somebody else killing you, and assisted suicide involves somebody else helping you to kill yourself. And suicide is you kill yourself. Nobody intentionally went out to try to make you dead. And that's what euthanasia and assisted suicide both involve, a primary intention that the person should become dead.
But I'm not an expert here, but I thought there was some way with certain drugs you can self-administer euthanasia.
Yeah.
So that's the same as suicide, isn't it?
No, because it's a person who prescribes the drugs does so, which was true, for example, of Dr. Rodney Syme in Melbourne, intending that if the person wants to, they could take all those drugs to commit suicide. That's assisted suicide.
Okay, well, you were talking about a lack of why. Do you see the younger Australians, because we're talking about Australia, do you see them as lacking something that older Australians have, some kind of belief system, or... Why do you say they're missing the why?
Well, maybe we're all missing the why, but if we're older, we've got more sort of resources, whether external or internal, in order to make life seem okay. I mean, in this talk, I gave an example of how some old people, and I've had several people tell me this, and they know I don't agree with what they want or they're going to do, but they've told me straight out, I'm not going into a nursing home. I've got the means to commit suicide, and I'll commit suicide before I would go into the nursing home. And indeed, when I did a Q&A on ABC, there was an older couple in the audience. I think she was 89 and he was 91. and they had a joint pact that they would commit joint suicide if they were told they had to go into a nursing home. And it was quite a fiery experience.
I remember it. I mean, in a sense, you were sort of ambushed on screen, although you handled yourself well. But what's wrong with their position? What's wrong with not wanting to go into a nursing home if you feel you're going to die in there and you prefer to die somewhere else?
Well, I think that it's... what I would hope is that we could give them enough options that they wouldn't find that they had no acceptable option for them. I mean, maybe that wouldn't happen, that couldn't be done, but there's a big difference between their going out and committing suicide, if that's what they're going to do, and we tried to give them all the support we could to persuade them otherwise, and having the state authorise somebody to help them to commit suicide or to give them a lethal injection rather than going to a nursing home. That's what we're dealing with.
So you're concerned, I mean, obviously you're concerned about increasing assisted dying in Australia. You've got examples, I think, already in Victoria, perhaps some other jurisdictions.
Yeah, Victoria and Western Australia, and Tasmania's looking at it, Queensland's looking at it, South Australia is, and there's a referendum in New Zealand when they hold the election, which has now been put off for a month, whether people approve of legalised euthanasia or not.
So to summarise, what's wrong with that?
I think that intentionally taking human life, I believe it's wrong.
Because it has consequences in other ages?
No, I believe it's inherently wrong in itself, that it's something we shouldn't do. That respect for life is one of the most important fundamental values on which we base our society. And no matter how much you might sympathise with somebody who wants to take their life, to actually help them to do it, or to actually, being blunt, Jared, using the word, to actually have a doctor kill them, which is what euthanasia is, I think that is inherently wrong. Even if you don't agree with me on that, I think the consequences of doing that and how that opens up a whole lot of other situations. For example, I was very active in that area in Canada opposing euthanasia. They brought the act in, they arranged it, they said there'll be very, very few deaths, this is just for emergency circumstances. Within a year, they had thousands of deaths. I think the total now is somewhere around 13,000 for the first just over 2.5 or 3 years. And now they've got new legislation in the parliament that you don't have to be terminally ill. Euthanasia could be used for a child. You can give an advance directive saying if I become demented, you can give me a lethal injection. And you can have it for what's called pure mental illness. You don't have to have a physical illness. It's enough if you've got mental illness. And then there's quite a lot of examples of that in the Netherlands and Belgium. In fact, the Netherlands has got a clinic called the End of Life Choices Clinic, and it mainly gives euthanasia to people who've been refused it by other doctors and who are mentally ill but not physically ill. So that's what you're looking at, you know. And back to the value of respect for life, that has to operate at two levels. It's got to operate for each person's individual life, and most of us want it to most of the time, and it's got to operate at the societal level. There's got to be an ambience of respect for life in your society, and no matter how you phrase it, the fact that you say, well, really one thing, what you're saying is being dead is better than being alive, that can't help but harm the value of respect for life.
So at the moment you're in the pandemic, maybe a little bit too late, although I think per head of population, Australia is probably doing very well in this area also, but you've got the focus is essentially in the COVID-19 situation right now in the middle of August is essentially focused on aged care.
Mm-hmm.
But as you know, this has consequences. Because of this great focus and hospitals being kept available for people of all ages, but many of them are going to be older people for COVID-19 treatments, that people who should be getting their cancer checkups are not getting it, men and women who need breast and prostate cancer checkups are not getting them. And so in the end result, the death rate from these not treated diseases and illnesses might be greater from those who die of the pandemic, because at the moment the figures are not particularly high.
But Jared, we're not just talking numbers here. We're talking people, and we're talking ethical systems of allocating medical treatment to people, particularly when that medical treatment is scarce. And so do you really think that you should have... I totally sympathise with people who've got conditions where they need treatment and they can't get it because someone's in hospital with COVID. But do you really think that we should sort them out by saying, you're old, you've got COVID, you don't get it, we're going to give it to this person? I mean, most people don't accept that.
Yeah, I'm sure they don't. But I find that if I talk to medical people in private medicine, they have a different attitude to people in public medicine. People in public medicine are essentially responsible for the various lockdowns that we have, the closing down of businesses. I mean, they advise governments. Governments make decisions, but governments make decisions on the basis of advice. Whereas if I talk to some medical people in private practice, they tend to think some of these clampdowns are unnecessary, they're more than they should be, and they're much more concerned about their existing patients who they're no longer seeing because they won't come into medical centres because they're worried or for whatever reason.
And also
they're more focused on them.
Yeah, and also those people are missing out on the fees that they normally earn. I mean, my experience...
Well, they are, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I've dealt with doctors like that, not here in Australia, but certainly in the US. We had ferocious, at an international level, ferocious fights about selling organs for transplant. And, most of the world said, no, that's unethical, illegal, and it's only poor people who sell and rich people who buy. But quite a lot of American transplant surgeons wanted it because they said our operating rooms are standing empty because we can't get the organs, and that means we can't earn the money that we think
yeah.
we're entitled to.
But you had a big jump here. I'm talking about local GPs and surgeons whose businesses are closing. You know, if the private sector health people go out of business, we're all going to suffer. I'm not talking about transplants. I'm just saying that I think that doctors in the public sector, as most people in the public sector, have quite a different attitude to business
yeah.
than those who are actually in the private sector driving the economy through their enterprise and initiatives.
But you know, Jerry, what we've got here is we've got a conflict of safety and well-being and care as compared with monetary concerns and damage to the economic system. They are both valid concerns, but we're in that world of competing sorrows that I talked about in the talk. When you can't avoid harming one or the other of them, which one do you choose to harm? And I know that the economic thing harms people more than at an economic level, but we don't have a choice. There is no harm option. And my experience, it's only anecdotal here in Australia, is that my friends who I would describe as more right-wing are very much on the anti-lockdown, let's get the economy going. And my friends who are much more public service, public health concerned, are on the other side. And so I don't know. I mean, I don't know how we're going to resolve that. I mean, also, some people are very cynical about this. I've, I've met some young people and I got a bit of a shock because they said to me, I don't know why you train to save all these old people. They said COVID is a boomer remover.
Well, I haven't heard that. I haven't heard that term before, but these days you can turn on a radio or a news bulletin and hear a report that someone aged 95 has died of COVID. But last year you'd never hear a report that someone in an aged home at the age of 95 had died of influenza, but there were many. I mean, we've had these influenza outbreaks, they've affected aged care homes, and they've passed by, and they caused concern at the time, but this seems to be much, much more focused than it was before. So I tend to think that actually there's much greater emphasis on older Australians than I've ever seen before.
It's much more infectious, it's much more lethal. And the other really scary thing that's starting to come out, because we thought that it was probably relatively harmless, like more or less like the flu in younger people. But the latest medical reports that are coming out are showing that there can be extraordinarily serious health consequences that are lifelong from this virus, and even in little babies and, you know, kids that get it. And it's, you know, they're looking at heart problems and kidney problems and all sorts of, you know, really bad effects. So it's a horrible thing, it really is.
I acknowledge that, but I'm just suggesting that the emphasis on older people is probably greater than it's been for a long time in Australia. Whereas you see a problem with the treatment of people in aged care,
yeah.
I see greater focus on aged care than I've ever seen before. I mean, I remember when I first went working for a politician 40 years ago in the early days of the Fraser government, and I was working in Tasmania, and with the federal minister in Tasmania, and I went into an aged care home, I think it was then called a nursing home, in Launceston, and I can still remember it. It was absolutely horrible,
yeah.
Absolutely horrible.
I know.
No, you don't find them now. So, I mean, as we've gone on, we've got better, except when I listen to your paper, I tend to get the impression that perhaps we've become less caring. I think we've become more caring.
Yeah, but maybe we still feel guilty about the fact that we don't keep our aged members of our families with us. I mean, this is all part of a huge social revolution of the 1960s and how our world has changed. And I don't know that there were that many people in aged care, and it wasn't such a routine thing, perhaps, as it has become now.
So you're talking about family attitude. So do you think there's been a failure of families in the last half, in the last 50 years? Do you think family life has deteriorated, that we're less interested in the old?
No, I don't think we're less
interested. Or just the old are living longer?
Yeah, you've got that. I think it's a collision of multiple factors. It's a tsunami. It's not just one thing. There's lots of things contributing to it. And also, you know, if you look at who the people are that are working in aged care and how they're on minimal wage and they've had to go from one to another job, and if they were infected, they took the infection with them. I mean, it's when I spoke of systems negligence. What do we need for a non-negligent system of aged care? And I think the other thing is that those images on the television, I mean, it's so sad of a poor old lady longingly looking out a locked window. And as one of them said, I couldn't even just see my relatives through the glass because there was a fence with poles, you know, like iron poles. She said it was like being in a prison and looking at them from the inside. And I mean, that's another interesting population. One of the suggestions for giving the vaccine to the most vulnerable people, one of the groups that have been named are actually prisoners, because they're more at risk than people outside of those institutions. So I don't know how the public would react to that.
There are not that many prisoners.
Aren't there?
Well, not when you're looking at a population of 25 million. But it's an interesting point. But the focus has been on, on aged care, as you point out. So just to summarise, I mean, how bad is the problem, which is in the topic of your talk, how bad is the problem of ageism? Because we have age pensions, which some people might say are small, but compared with other countries, they're okay. We don't have many aged people who are homeless. We have some, but we seem to be handling our age fairly well compared with probably what we did in the past. But you feel, how do you identify the problem of what you describe as ageism?
Well, I think one of the issues is, and I can't remember the exact figure, and I'm one of this group, that there's a record number, and it's quite high, of people living alone in Australia now. And that's true of all Western democratic societies. And so one of the things that's being named as sort of another companion epidemic, really, you could add it to the title, is loneliness. And even when people have got a family and they're put into aged care, there's lots of reports about how they're not visited by the family or the grandchildren or whatever. And, you know, somehow we've lost our sense of duty in that respect. In fact, duty is almost a nasty word. It sort of sounds as though we didn't want to do it, but we had to do it because it was our duty. And I mean, there's a lot of wonderful people who do look after old people who otherwise would be lost and abandoned. And you're right, it's also because we didn't live so long once and we become fragile. It's not a nice thing to look forward to.
Well, you called it the world of competing sorrows, others called it another manifestation of the fall of man. It's much the same story, isn't it?
I guess so, yeah. Well, it depends, Jerry, if you're religious. I guess you belong in the fall of man category.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I think that's a pessimistic view of man.
And your optimistic view is?
My optimistic view is, and that's what I meant when I spoke about social capital, that this how we handle this COVID crisis, we will either become a better society or a worse society. And I hope that we become a better one. That's what my optimistic view is.
Margaret Sunville, thanks for making a contribution to the former.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.